begun recording now, which I know is something that I usually get reminded about. So we'll go ahead and get things underway. Before we get to pick up the study on the tabernacle, I did receive one question that I wanted to take a little bit of time with. It's an interesting question. It's one that really makes you stop and think, and that really is deserving of much more time than we'll be able to give to it just tonight in a brief response. It's a question that many people have, and one that probably all of us have considered at one time or another. I'll read the question to you. It says, sometimes, or something I ponder over is the harshness in the Old Testament, the killing of everyone in cities, even children. But I understand that God had to do it that way to totally rid those areas of pagan worship. But I also see it in the instructions God gave when someone did something worthy of death. But again, I know that God needed the people to obey totally, and if the punishments were carried out as instructed, that they would serve as a deterrent to others. But, and here's the question, in Leviticus 20, verse 14, it says, regarding a couple that's been caught in adultery, says, they shall be burned with fire, quote unquote. And the question is, or the response here, is that it's hard for me to comprehend that. I looked up the word fire in Strong's Concordance, and it says that it's a primitive word, could be literal or figurative, and I would think in this case it's literal. Can you give me some insight into this? So the question is about whether God is harsh in his treatment, either to the Canaanites or to those who are caught in this particular sin. So really, there seem to be two questions that are here. One is about the harshness of God in the killing of everyone in the cities of Canaan, including little children. That does, to many, appear to be harsh and unnecessary, and it runs counter to our sensitivities. It leads some people to doubt or even to judge God. Now, the person who wrote this question is not doing that, to be sure, but that's the conclusion that some have come to. We know, though, as the person who sent this question also expressed, that the purpose for the complete destruction of the culture of the pagans was ultimately to protect Israel from the influence of paganism. And there's a good example of why that was important, why it would have been important for them to do that. In Numbers 25, I won't turn there, but you might want to. There's an account of how even before they entered the land of Canaan, the people of Israel were seduced and they were drawn into committing sexual sins and worshiping the gods of the Moabites. Now, this is just before they entered the promised land. They've been in the wilderness for some 40 years being led by God, and yet seemingly they were easily drawn astray by that influence. So the threat posed by paganism was real, and that's the reason that they were instructed to completely eradicate the entire culture when they entered the land. It was for their own good. There are many warnings in the book, in particular in Deuteronomy, of God repeatedly telling the people not to adopt the ways of the pagans, not to worship him the way they worship their gods, not to be drawn into the immorality of those pagan systems. I'll just mention Deuteronomy 12, verses 29 through 32. That's a passage that we often quote to make that point. So the question is whether God was unfair and harsh in treating the people in this way. Of course, we know that God's ultimate plan is to resurrect those, all of those who died in ignorance, and give them an opportunity to receive salvation. So all those who died in those circumstances will be given that opportunity at the time of the White Throne Judgment. In a general sense, let's look at one passage here in Isaiah 55, verse 8. Isaiah 55, verse 8 says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, Nor are my ways your ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So, whatever we can think, God can think better. Whatever we think might be right isn't necessarily going to be the way that God would deal with something. Our thoughts, our ideas, our conclusions are not worthy compared to what God is doing, what he knows that he's doing. And so the treatment of these people may not seem right to some other people to in a human sense, but God has a plan, and he is going to work out his plan according to what he's doing, not according to what we would judge him for. And we continue in the next couple of verses that explains that even further. It says, for as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and do not return there, but water the earth and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it will accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. God will do what he will do, and he's doing it for his purpose, and he's not going to fail. All the action he takes is based on his mind, his thoughts, his way, and the fulfillment of his word. So people may judge God, but that's the way he handled those situations. What instructions he gave to Israel are not something that we should judge to be too harsh. It's just the way that God is dealing with it, and he has a plan ultimately for all of those. Then the other question here is on Leviticus 20, verse 14. Let's look at that. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 14. If a man marries a woman and her mother, it is wickedness. They shall be burned with fire, both he and they, that there be no wickedness among you. So if a man enters into a marriage that's really both incest and adultery, then they are to be punished. So the question seems to be why God would impose such a harsh punishment to be burned with fire in this particular instance. And that would certainly be a gruesome way to die. And it would seem to be, in our human reasoning, that that would be very cruel and harsh. And again, maybe not even humanly seem to be necessary. But let's look at this in the context. We're back up to verse 1 in chapter 20. Verses 1 through 9 shows that there is a death penalty for a number of different kinds of sins. And those sins, I'm not going to read this whole section, but those sins for which there is a death penalty includes the worship of Molech, which involved sexual immorality, sexual perversion, and the literal sacrificing of children. It also includes consulting with demons and being cursing, disrespecting in a gross manner their parents. All of those examples are things that undermine the true worship of God and would be very harmful to the community if people were to practice those things. So they are strictly prohibited with a very, very definite punishment that would be inflicted. Notice, though, in verse 2 of Leviticus 20. Again, he says, say to the children of Israel, whoever of the children of Israel or the strangers who dwell in the land who give any of their descendants to Molech, okay, in other words, they sacrifice their children, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. This is the manner in which the capital punishment was carried out. They were stoned with stones. Now, that also would frankly be a very gruesome way to die. You know, to have, to be pummeled to death by huge rocks and stones, that the people who were accusing would be actually carrying out. There's a very graphic explanation of what it meant to be stoned. In one of the commentaries, the Jameson Fawcett and Brown commentary, I won't read it all, it's a couple of paragraphs long, but again, it was a very brutal way to die, but that was the manner of execution that God said that they should do. Now that's in verse 2. Now drop down to verse 10, there's a whole list now here of sexual sins, including adultery. After condemning adultery and other sexual sins that are also to be punishable by death, they're listed here beginning in verse 10. It includes incest, homosexuality, marrying women who are related to the mother and daughter, so and as we saw earlier. Those are specific sins that were punishable by death. Most likely, as we see in the context here, most likely those who were guilty of those sins were first of all stoned to death, and then their bodies were burnt or cremated. They weren't necessarily burned to death, but they were stoned, as we saw in verse 2. That's the manner in which the execution was carried out. And then their bodies were burned. And again, there's an example of that in Joshua chapter 7. Joshua chapter 7, it's a fairly involved story. After the Israelites had come into the land, they first of all conquered Jericho, and then next they were sent to destroy the little city of Ai, which is much smaller than Jericho. But they were defeated. The Israelites were defeated when they attacked the city of Ai. And the reason you see as you read the story was that someone in Israel had brought back with them some of the pagan idols and the treasures of the city. And they had been commanded specifically not to do that. And when they were found out, let's look at that in Joshua chapter 7, when they were found to have, the person who did that was identified, Joshua 7, verse 15, then it shall be that he who has taken the accursed thing shall be burned with fire, he and all that he has and his family with him. So here is another case where he was to be burned by fire for committing that sin, for directly disobeying God's specific command. That's dropped down though to the end of the chapter, verse 25. They figured out by a process of elimination that it was a man named Achan who had done this and had brought back their idols and the treasures from Ai. Verse 25, Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." So all Israel stoned him with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them. So that was the manner of execution. They were stoned, and then their bodies were burned. Again, it's a very harsh punishment in a sense. It would be a capital punishment and not a pleasant way to die, but that was the way it was done. It's not maybe quite as brutal as it might sound just looking at the one verse there in Leviticus chapter 20. Now, how God is going to work out his plan is a much bigger subject and would take much more time to fully explore the way that he deals with, the way that he has punished people in the past. There was the flood. There was the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. There'll be the tribulation at the end of the age. There's a lot of instances where God will be very strong in his punishment. But it's for his purpose, and it ultimately is for good. Okay, let's go ahead and move on then into a discussion, a little further discussion of where we left off in talking about the tabernacle. In the last study, we reviewed the timeline of Israel as they came out of Egypt and came through the wilderness to Mount Sinai, and then the episode where after being entering into a covenant with God. They broke that covenant, built the idol, the golden calf. That was all part of the scene that led up to when Moses had to go up the mountain the second time to receive the tablets of stone with God's writing on it, the law. And then, after all that, they finally were able to begin building the tabernacle and all of its furnishings. Tonight, what we're going to do is consider some of the responsibilities of the priesthood and of the tribe of Levi and their service at the tabernacle. As I mentioned before, there's no timeline dating that's given in the book of Leviticus. And if you compare Exodus 40, verse 17, and then skip over Leviticus to Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, you see that the tabernacle was completed within 2 weeks of the anniversary of their departing from Egypt. Almost exactly a year later, just 2 weeks short of that, they finished the tabernacle. And in Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, you see that now another month has gone by since the completion of the tabernacle. And that's where the story that picks up here in the book of Numbers. So in Numbers chapter 1, we see that after they had completed that work on the tabernacle, then God instructed them to do a census of the people. In chapter 1, verse 2, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel by their families, by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male individually from 20 years older and above. So there's a census taken of counting every male from age 20 and older. And the numbers in the rest of the chapter 1 here gives the numbers and some of the prominent family members of each of those groups of these families, or the tribes. I do find it interesting, as you look down through here, they're grouped by the name of the son of Jacob. There's Reuben and Simeon and Gad and Judah and so on. That they had not lost track of their family lineage. All of these people had maintained their separation or their family identity. In Genesis 49, there are specific prophecies given about each of the sons of Jacob and their prophecies about them in the last days. So God intended for these 12 tribes to be identifiable, and they would develop into distinct nations. So even in the confusion and the difficulties of captivity, these 12 families didn't blend together, but they remained separate, and they developed into separate, what we call tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel, what later became nations. So that's just something that I find interesting as you consider how the nation of Israel here is organized when they come out of Egypt. Verses 4 through 53 in Numbers 1, 4 through 43, summarize the count of each tribe, each group. And then you come to verse 44. These are the ones who were numbered, whom Moses and Aaron numbered, with the leaders of Israel, 12 men, each one representing his father's house. So they had a very structured approach to taking this census. So all who were numbered of the children of Israel by their father's houses from 20 years old and above and were able to go to war in Israel, all were numbered, were 603,550. That was the total number that were counted. The men 20 and older in each of the tribes. Now we have that many men age 20 and older. You can see that we take into account that many of them, most of them would have been married and had families of their own. We can see there easily would have been 2 to 3 million Israelites, that we're talking about here. Now, as you go down through Numbers 1, you'll see that there are 12 family groups that are mentioned. But you'll notice that the tribe of Joseph has two descendants that are in this census. the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, who are the descendants of Joseph, are treated as tribes themselves, even though they were really the sons of Joseph. So the two of them are included, but Levi was not included. So there are 12, but there are two that are descendants of Joseph, and Levi is left out. Levi was not included in the census because they were to be given a special responsibility. Their job was going to be to maintain the tabernacle and to do the work of the tabernacle. We'll get to that in a minute, but Levi is not part of this census. Two other things to mention quickly. Each family grouping is identified by its own flag. Verse 52, a flag or a banner. The children of Israel shall pitch their tents, everyone by his own camp, everyone by his own standard, according to their armies or their groupings. And so they all had an identifying insignia or flag for their tribe. We also see here that the tabernacle is referred to as the tabernacle of meeting. In verses 49 through 50, it's referred to as the tabernacle of meeting. Now, most of the time, the tabernacle is called just that, called the tabernacle. But on several instances, about 143 actually in the Old Testament, the tabernacle is called the tabernacle of meeting. This is the place, then, that God has identified where he will meet with his people. And so it's used, again, 141 times in the Old Testament, in the King James, New King James translation. There's also a handful of times when the tabernacle is referred to as the tabernacle of the testimony. And remember, we saw in Exodus 25, verse 16, that the testimony was the items that were put into the ark that were to be a witness or a reminder of their covenant with God. That was called the testimony. In Hebrews 9, verses 3 through 5, identify what was in the Ark of the Covenant. It was the tablets of stone, a bowl or a sample of manna, and Aaron's staff. And these were the testimony. These were the witness of God's, of their covenant with God. In Numbers chapter 2, we find more about the organization of the camp, the positioning of the tribes. There were three on each side of, the tabernacle was in the middle, three tribes, north, south, east, and west. Each of those points of the compass, there were three tribes. And then the Levites, and Moses and Aaron were right by at the tabernacle. That's how the camp was organized. That's described in Numbers chapter 2. In chapter 3, we find some detail about the organization of the work at the tabernacle and the general organization of the camp of Israel. So we'll look a little bit at how it's described here in chapter 3. In verses 1 through 4, we see the lineage of Moses and Aaron. Now, these are the records of Aaron and Moses when the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. Now, the word records could be translated generations. These are the generations or the descendants of Aaron and Moses. And these are the names of the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu and Eleazar and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priests, whom he consecrated to minister as priests. First of all, we'll point out that Moses and Aaron were Levites. We can trace their lineage through their generations. We know that Jacob had 12 sons, one of whom was Levi. Levi was his third son by Leah. Levi was one of the sons of Jacob. Levi also had three sons. one of whom was a man named Kohath. And that's recorded in Genesis 46, verse 11. Genesis 46, verse 11 says, lists the sons of Kohath. Though Kohath and his, okay, well, let's not get sidetracked yet. Kohath then had four sons. Exodus 6, verse 18 says Kohath had four sons, one of whom was Amram, and Amram was the father of Moses and Aaron. So they were the grandsons, Moses and Aaron were the grandsons of Kohath, and the great-grandsons of Levi. But they were of the tribe of Levi. We also know that Moses had two sons. Exodus 18 talks about how, let's go ahead and briefly look there. Exodus chapter 18, Moses' father-in-law brought, Jethro brought Zipporah, his wife, Moses' wife, and Moses' two sons to him when they were at Mount Sinai. Jethro, the priest of Midian, Exodus 18, verse 1. Moses' father-in-law heard what God had done for Moses and for Israel and his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom and the other was Eleazar. And it shows the names, the meanings of their names. Now, Moses had sent Zipporah and his sons back to Jethro during the time of the Exodus, just because it was, I guess, maybe safer or easier for them. But here in Exodus 18, we just see that Jethro brought Zipporah and their sons, back to be reunited with Moses. Now, this is the last time that Moses' sons are mentioned in Scripture. We know nothing else about them. We don't see their lineage. We don't see any of their descendants. We don't see any responsibilities they had in the nation of Israel. This is the last we know of them. But Aaron and his descendants became the priests. Moses' family is not included for whatever reason, but the family of Aaron then became the anointed priests of the nation and would serve then at the tabernacle. Now we have to kind of skip around a little bit to get a picture of the priesthood and how it was established. And I think it's worthwhile to understand a little bit about how the tabernacle was, how it functioned, how it was organized, and who had responsibilities at the tabernacle. If we go to Exodus 29, we see that, we remember that this is the section of Scripture that describes the build, how the tabernacle was to be built, and some about how the work of the tabernacle would be done. These instructions were given to Moses the first time he was on the mountain. And in chapter 29, there's an entire chapter about a special ceremony in which the priesthood would be consecrated. The priesthood will be set aside or identified formally by God's anointing. Chapter 29, verse 1. This is what you shall do to them to hallow them as for ministering to me as priests. This is a special sacrifice that was done. Then verse 4 says, Aaron and his sons you shall bring to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, wash them with water, and then they put on special garments. So it is Aaron and his sons that are identified and consecrated as the priests of the people who served at the tabernacle. Notice in verse 9, you shall gird them with sashes, Aaron and his sons, and put hats on them, so there's special clothing that they wore that identified them as part of the office they served. And it says, the priesthood shall be theirs for a perpetual statute. So you shall consecrate Aaron and his sons. So Aaron and his sons, his descendants then, were the priesthood. This is the Levitical priesthood. This is the beginning of what we often refer to as the Levitical priesthood. It was through the tribe of Levi, Aaron, who was a great-grandson of Levi, and then through his sons, then who became the priests in perpetuity of the people. This is when they were identified. Now, Leviticus chapter 8 actually describes the ceremony that took place after the tabernacle was built. This is the ceremony then where Aaron and his sons are formally consecrated. Again, verses 1 through 3 describe a special offering that was made on their behalf. It's a very formal situation. It's a very special offering. The people, it says in verse 4, gather to be a witness of the ceremony. And then in verses 10 through 12, in Leviticus 8, the tabernacle itself, the furnishings and the tabernacle and Aaron are consecrated. In other words, they're anointed, they're set aside by God for their special purpose. Verse 13 in Leviticus 8, again, now Aaron and his sons are given those priestly robes and hats that we saw mentioned in Exodus 29. And then in verses 14 through 36, I'm just kind of giving you a quick outline, Moses makes the offerings that consecrate Aaron and his sons. Now, Moses was not a priest. Aaron was the priest. But Moses was the chosen leader that God had given that responsibility, again, of leadership. And so, in order to establish the priesthood, Moses, who is not a priest, offers a special offering. And from that point on, now the sacrifices will be given by the priesthood, by Aaron, and later by his descendants. And so verses 14 through 36 describe this scene where Moses makes the offerings to consecrate Aaron and his sons. In Leviticus 9, there are some more ceremonies that take place after the priesthood has been established. They begin now to take their responsibilities. Notice in Leviticus 9, down to verse 22. Leviticus 9, verse 22. Aaron lifted his hand toward the people. This is at the end of the ceremony where he has been consecrated as the priest. He lifted his hand toward the people, blessed them, and came down from offering the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of meeting and came out and blessed the people. Now something very significant happens here. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people, and fire came down from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offerings and fat on the altar. When all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. They were, you know, they were shocked. They were overwhelmed by this special scene where fire, maybe lightning, I'm not sure how fire comes out of heaven in the way it's described here, comes down on the altar, and the offering itself is burned on the altar. Then, chapter 10, verse 1, Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord that he had not commanded them to do. The fire comes down on the altar that is at the tabernacle, in the courtyard, the enclosed area of the tabernacle is where this altar is, and it burns this offering. And the coals from that fire then are the special fire from the Lord. And those coals were kept burning constantly. There were sacrifices in the morning and in the evening. The fire that God had sent to burn those offerings never went out. It was like the eternal flame. The Olympics have what they call the eternal flame. It's supposed to be, you know, some torch that is always burning. This was the, these were this was the fire that God had sent. The priests were to take coals from that fire in the morning and in the evening into the tabernacle and use those coals for the incense that was burned in the tabernacle. That was because it was holy fire from God, and that's the only fire that was to be used in the tabernacle. Now, what Nadab and Abihu did was they took fire from another source and brought it into the tabernacle. And they were executed for that. God, because they did not honor God properly as they were to do, then they were punished for that. It says that they died. And it was profane. It was ordinary. And, not sure whether they were just careless or whether they thought it didn't matter. They were defiant in some way, but God wanted it to be absolutely clear that this had great significance to him, and they were not to use any other fire on the altar of incense. And so, after that, then only two of Aaron's sons then, remained to help him and to serve as priests. There's more about the priesthood in Leviticus 21. Leviticus 21, identifies Aaron's, again, family as to be the priests, but not only were they to be descendants of Aaron, but the priests also had to be without physical blemish. They, in order to serve, as priests. So God was very particular about Aaron and his sons and their responsibilities and how they carried them out. And there were there's some significance to that when we get later to the new covenant, to the priesthood of Melchizedek, to the high priest that serves today at the temple of God in heaven. So that this is all symbolic in the old covenant. And that much of that symbolism carries through then into the new covenant. Numbers chapter 3, verse 5. I only read the first couple of verses there. Let's go to Numbers chapter 3, verse 5. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the tribe of Levi near and present them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. And they shall attend to his needs and the needs of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of meeting to do the work of the tabernacle. So the Levites, who were not given, not included in the census, and it's because they were given to God to serve at the tabernacle. The descendants of Aaron were the priests, and the Levites, the rest of the descendants of the tribe of Levi, were to work for and support the priesthood. So, to use kind of different twist on a common phrase, we could say that all priests were Levites, but not all Levites were priests. The vast majority of the Levites worked at the tabernacle, and their service was to the people and to God at the tabernacle. But only the sons, the descendants of Aaron, were priests. Now, in order for that to be accomplished, something else here is done. We find in verse 11, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, now behold, this is Numbers 3, verse 11, I myself have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel instead of every firstborn who opens the womb among the children of Israel. Therefore the Levites shall be mine, because all the firstborn are mine. Now, to understand that connection, we look at Exodus chapter 13, verse 1. Exodus 13. This is at the time when Israel is coming out of Egypt. Exodus 12, you may remember, is where we have the Israelites leaving Egypt on the night of the night too much observed. And so Exodus 13 is given in that same context. It says in verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, saying, consecrate to me all the firstborn. Whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and beast, it is mine. All the firstborn, God claimed to be a service to him, to serve him. This was a matter of honoring God, of showing the importance of God, that every firstborn son or even a creature, a beast, was to be set aside for service to God. Later in the chapter, you see that they can be redeemed. In other words, instead of actually going in some way to specifically serve God, they were redeemed. There was a price was paid. But they had to be redeemed in order for them to no longer be specifically set aside for God. Exodus 13, verse 13. Let's see. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. If you don't redeem it, you have to break its neck. All the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. So this was a matter of God claiming and the people honoring God by recognizing that their firstborn belonged to God and either went to him in service or was redeemed, had to be purchased. So we go back then to Numbers 3. Numbers 3, verse 14. How is it that the Levites took the place of all the firstborn who God had claimed to be his? Verse 14, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness, and he said, number the children of Israel by their fathers' houses, by their families. Number every individual who is a male from 1 month and older. So there's a census now specifically of the Levites, done a little bit differently. Instead of being 20 years and older, it was 1 month and older. So list the names of the sons of Levi. Gershom, Kohath, and Merari. And so the census is taken of all of them. Verse 17 through 39, you find the counting of the people by their families, how many Levites there were as this census were taken. Okay. And it turns out that there were 22,000 Levites who were counted in this census. Between the three families, there were Gershom, Kohath, and Merari. There were 22,000 males 1 month and older. These then were dedicated to the service of God at the tabernacle in place of the firstborn of the tribes of Israel. But notice verse 40 here in this chapter. Numbers 3, verse 40. Number all the firstborn males of the children of Israel from a month and above, and take the number of their names, and you shall take the Levites for me instead of the firstborn children of Israel. So Moses numbered them, verse 42. And all the firstborn males, verse 43, according to the number of names from a month and above, of those who were numbered were 22,273. So there are 273 more Israelites 1 month and above than there are Levites 1 month and above. The 22,000 Levites, if they're going to take the place of the firstborn Israelites, there's not quite enough. So there were 273 more Levites. I'm sorry, 273 more Israelites than there were Levites. So those 273 then were redeemed. Verse 48. You shall give the, verse 46, for the redemption of the 273 of the firstborn of Israel, who are more than the number of the Levites, you shall take 5 shekels for each one individually and take them in the currency to the sanctuary. In other words, those 273 then were redeemed. And the other 22,000 took the place of the first 22,000 of the Israelites. It's kind of complicated. But I think it really indicates how God structured things. He was very careful to take the same number of Levites as there were firstborn, plus those that were in addition to be, had to be redeemed. It shows that God is detailed. God is very structured, and the things were done according to what He commanded them to do. To me, it's just kind of an interesting insight into what God is like and how careful He is to do things according to a real structural organization that He has in mind. And even just looking at the people of Israel, I showed you a chart last time of how the camps were set up around the tabernacle and how they were each set up, in an orderly fashion, and they all were led by their own banner, their own flag, represented their tribe, what would become their nation. This isn't just a big mob of 3 million people wandering around in the desert. God is very, very much structured and organized in teaching them to be, to be careful in the way that they obey Him, and to recognize, the instructions that He has given to them, the way that they should be established. Now, what do all these Levites do? Well, Numbers 4 gives us a little bit of insight into that. Numbers 4 describes and summarizes the duties of the Levites at the tabernacle. We see in verse 1 that the priests were to serve at the tabernacle from ages 30 to 50. Between the ages of 30 and 50 is when they had their actual formal service at the tabernacle. In verse 48 of Numbers 4, we see that those Levites who could serve at the tabernacle were 8,580. There were a total of 8,580 Levites who could serve at the tabernacle. This is out of the total of 22,000. There were 8,500 who were between the ages of 30 and 50, then who were available to work at the tabernacle. In Numbers 4, beginning in about from 1 through 15, it describes the duties of the descendants of Kohath. And then in verses 21 through 28, describes the duties of the family of Gershon. And then verses 29 through 33 describes the responsibilities of the sons of Merari. So each family, all of the Levites were to serve at the tabernacle. Those who were between the ages of 30 and 50 actually did their service at the tabernacle, and they were divided by their families, and they each had specific responsibilities. But mostly it describes here how they would move the tabernacle. The tabernacle was constructed very carefully, and it was to be taken special care of. And so when it came time for Israel to move from one location to another, then there were specific responsibilities given to each of the families for the part that they would carry out, what they would do, how they would disassemble the tabernacle, how they would carry it, transporting it, and then they would then, of course, set it up again when the cloud or the pillar of fire stopped and they were to camp. So again, very careful, very structured. You know, the tabernacle lasted from the time it was built until the time of Solomon, more than 400 years. That's a long time for a tent to survive. It was made of the highest quality, and a lot of special care was taken to be sure that that it was handled properly. Again, see in Numbers 4, we have the responsibilities of these three groups of Levite families. Then we come to chapter 7. Chapter 7. Now, all of this structure, organization, this census taking, these responsibilities being laid out, all of this occurred within, a relatively short period of time. Because we come to chapter 7, and it says, "It came to pass when Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle that he anointed it and consecrated it and its furnishings." So we're still at the very beginning of the time when the tabernacle is completed and everything is being set up and organized. So in chapter 7, we see that there was a very special dedication of the tabernacle and its furnishings. And again, I'm not going to take the time to read it, but for 12 days, each tribe in turn made a special offering to consecrate the tabernacle. This was very formal, and it was a matter of each tribe or each group, each family, doing its part to dedicate, to consecrate, to establish the tabernacle. And they all played a role or all had their own special offering that they gave. So you can read through chapter 7. It's a lengthy chapter that describes the sacrifice or the special ceremony of each tribe for the dedication or the consecration of the tabernacle. And finally, in verse 89 of this chapter, it says, "When Moses went into the tabernacle of meeting to speak with him, with God, he heard the voice of one speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony from between the two cherubim. Thus he spoke to him." So this is the first time that the tabernacle actually functions as the place where God dwells. And at this time, after all this ceremony, after all these, the structure and organization has been established, now Moses, for the first time, goes into the tabernacle. He's outside of the Holy of Holies. He's in the holy place. And from within the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant is and with the mercy seat on top of it, from there God speaks to Moses through that curtain or that divider between the holy place and the Holy of Holies. But right then, this is the time or the place when God actually then begins to communicate with Moses at the tabernacle. So this long process of everything they went through before building it, and then the building of it, and then all the details about the organization and the structure and the service at the tabernacle, this is pretty much the conclusion then of God setting up the tabernacle. Chapter 8, we have another consecration, another dedication. Chapter Numbers 8, there are a series of sacrifices that are the consecration of the priesthood. I'm sorry, the consecration of the Levites. We already saw back in Leviticus 11, we saw the consecration of the priesthood. Now, in Numbers 8, now that the the responsibilities of the Levites have been established. In Numbers 8, we have the consecration of the Levites and the formal setting aside of them for the duties and responsibilities that are going to be given to them. So that then kind of completes the structure, the organization, the establishing of the tabernacle. And so we'll just conclude for tonight in Numbers chapter 9, verse 15. Numbers chapter 9, verse 15. Because on the day that the tabernacle was raised up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, from evening until morning. It was above the tabernacle like the appearance of fire. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day, and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, after that the children of Israel would journey. In the place where the cloud settled, there the children of Israel would pitch their tents. At the command of the Lord, the children of Israel would journey, and at the command of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud stayed above the tabernacle, they remained encamped. So that's kind of, again, the scene we have that when the tabernacle was completed. It goes on to describe a little bit further here. But when the tabernacle is completed, from that point on, the cloud is over the tabernacle, specifically over the Holy of Holies, and the appearance of fire at night. And it would lead them then through the wilderness. People sometimes think, well, you know, when the church has a decision to make, or maybe there's some kind of a difficulty or a crisis, don't we wish we had a cloud or a pillar of fire to show us what to do, to lead the way? Of course, we understand that this presence of God at the tabernacle is symbolic of the presence of God in his people today by the Holy Spirit. And people think, well, you know, we wish God would be more specific and clear and show us the way he showed Israel just exactly what to do. But he does give us direction. He does give us, it is his presence then that leads his church, except now is by his Holy Spirit. So, I don't think we lack for direction from God. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. I don't think we really are lacking the specific help that we need from God as he leads us in our time. So that's where we're going to end up for tonight. Again, we've brought this story of the tabernacle pretty much to the point where it's completed, and now the people of Israel will be led through the wilderness toward their promised land. More adventures to come. We know that it wasn't smooth from this point on for Israel, but at this point we're following the story at least to get to the finishing of the tabernacle. Next time, we're going to cover and discuss the time between Moses' completion of the tabernacle, and we'll do a very brief overview of the history of the tabernacle up to the time of Solomon. We know that Solomon, after the plans had been drawn up by David, built the temple that replaced the tabernacle. But we'll see what some of the events are and some of the history of the tabernacle, of the Ark of the Covenant, specifically from the time of Moses to the time of Solomon. And then the study following that will get to a discussion of the building of the temple, Solomon's temple. So we're making our way through this history. Don't want to get too bogged down, but also don't we need to get into much more detail than we have in our discussions so far. So, I have, on my end, now unmuted everyone. So you would be able to make any comments or ask any questions if you would like. Then we'll go ahead and wrap up the study for this evening.
Hey, Mr. Anson, this is Warren.
Yes.
Hey, I lost my audio for a little while. I was wondering, what approximate year was that whenever Moses went into the tabernacle?
What year was it?
Yeah, just approximately, you know.
Well, let's see. It was probably about 1442 B.C. They left. They came out of Egypt in 1443 B.C. It took about a year then to build the tabernacle. So the best estimate would be 1442 B.C.
Okay, thank you. That was a lot of people to have there, you know. That's unbelievable. There were that many people in the desert like that, you know.
Yeah, well, it was in the whole nation. Yeah. You know, God brought the whole nation into to take over the land of Canaan. So a lot of people.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sure. All right. Or forever hold your peace. If you have any questions or comments.
No, that was very good. Thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome.
Mr. Anson.
Nobody else has anything they want to add or subtract? Okay, well, I've said all I need to say tonight. My wife and I plan to be at both services tomorrow. We'll be at Pittsburgh in the morning, and then with the Wheeling congregation in the afternoon. So it's been a couple of weeks since we did the circuit. We're at both services. We're looking forward to being with everybody tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson.
Glad you could tune in.
Okay, see you tomorrow.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Have a blessed tomorrow.